This episode of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 5th of May 2014 on Monaco 24.
Welcome to the 134th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. This week, we're waving our microphone at quite a bit of art and how we see and hear about it. Getting over our phobia of that pop star with a huge papier-mâché head from our teenage years, snapping with rock stars and, well, and more. Okay, here's what's what. We'll take a look at how two venerable museums are changing up their offerings. Alain de Botton's Art is Therapy show aims to change our gaze.
So this is an intervention for people who might enjoy reading a slightly longer caption that's a bit more personal in tone and is guiding them to some good ideas they might have around works of art.
While at Madrid's Prado, you'll hear something rather different.
I think an app like this can give real added value, whether you're a person who can visit the museum or whether you want to explore the works of art in the museum from your comfort of your own home on your own TV screen.
John Ronson is in to talk about Frank, the Michael Fassbender starring film based on Ronson's days, playing keys for the frankly scary Frank Sidebottom.
We sent a message back saying, is he definitely aware that he spends the entirety of a movie in a big fake head?
And that chronicler of rock's golden age, Lynn Goldsmith, swings by, selfies and all, to tell us her rock and roll stories.
Well, basically, I think I'm a photo slut.
Plus, we'll visit the Bogota Book Fair and get a preview of Art Basel Hong Kong and wear our hearts on our sleeves with former Walkman turned solo troubadour Hamilton Lighthouser. He is our Midori House session this week. That's all coming up here on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. But first, let's enjoy a tune from this week's Midori House session. The recently announced on-again, off-again extreme hiatus of perma-furrowed-browed jangly New Yorkers The Walkmen, in English that means they've split up, means fans of the band have been wondering where to look for a fresh fix of wearied 5am melancholia. Turns out the band was more than merely the sum of its parts, with a host of Walkmen solo projects now set to hit stores. First out of the traps is frontman Hamilton Lighthouser, and he stopped by Midori House recently to deliver a belting rendition of new single, Alexandra.
I don't think back, I don't need to, but I'm always thinking of you. Alexandra, 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 Alexandra. All my roots are always stronger, dug deep and hard as marble. Alexandra, 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 Alexandra. So I tune out all the voices telling me it's time to swing again. Alexandra, Alexandra, Alexandra. Oh, there must be some signal, some green light left in your life. Will you whitewash your memory when I call you from the crazy sleep? Alexandra, 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 Alexandra. Well, I took a happy hour and I ran it through your heart. Don't you lose me to those blue skies. I still miss you when we swing apart. Alexandra, Alexandra, I don't think back, I don't need to, but I'm always thinking of you. Alexandra, 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 Alexandra.
That was part one of our Hamilton Lighthouser session, and the song's name is Alexandra. More from him to come later. What are museums for? Damn it, what is art for? The philosopher Alain de Botton thinks that art can be therapy. It can guide us through the pleasures, sorrows and complications of modern life by telling us things about ourselves and others, mopping our brow, smoothing down our hair and soothing us. In a new intervention, as much as a show, at Amsterdam's wonderful Rijksmuseum, de Botton has suggested in a series of big, bold, yellow post-it notes on museum walls other ways in which to interpret the works on display. What if we're falling out of love? There's a painting for that. What if we feel poor? There's an 11th century Chinese dish that'll put that old chestnut in context, etc. Better him than me, though. I went to Amsterdam last week to speak to Alain about the show Art is Therapy.
Well, I think the number one thing the museum does is to leave us alone with works of art. They just give us tiny captions, when it was painted, you know, who the artist was, you know, who it was sold by, etc. And otherwise, you're on your own. And some people, that's fine, that's great. They know exactly what they want to do, off they go. For other people, they're like, I don't know, what am I supposed to do in front of this kind of weird thing, this ship, etc. So this is an intervention for people who might enjoy reading a slightly longer caption that's a bit more personal in tone and is guiding them to some good ideas they might have around works of art.
In a way, then, de Botton is suggesting that it's whatever works for you, that we should be encouraged to react to art as we would tap our foot to a song. How does de Botton's intervention look on these hallowed walls, though?
The designer of these captions, Irma Baum, also designed the museum caption system generally. And she was very keen to say, we've got to differentiate it. We can't just make something that looks just a bit like an ordinary caption. And she hit upon this idea of the post-it note, something that, you know, we all use, often for marking down pretty important stuff that we don't want to forget. We put it by, you know, our desks or whatever. And she thought, wouldn't this be a great idea for the captions? So that's what she's done. I think it works really well. As you say, it's a bit punk. It's unconventional, but it works. And what it shows is really that, look, these words might not be the words that you need right now for this picture, but make your own. We're trying to teach a method of looking at art, a more personal, intimate method of looking at art, more therapeutic. And you can do that with lots of different pictures, not just the ones we've chosen. You could write your own captions, as it were, in your mind.
And he's right. In art, there's no such thing as a wrong answer. But most people quite like to be led to some sort of conclusion, some sort of an answer, something to take away with them that, different to a tea towel with the sunflowers on it, gives them a rush of understanding. But the general visitor sometimes struggles with this. Maybe it's the layout's fault. Maybe dates and styles mean nothing.
Most museums are arranged through centuries, 18th century, 19th century, etc. That's a really banal way of organising material. I think it's much more interesting to do it by the big themes, and the themes that touch us all. Money, love, sex, relationships, work, politics. It's kind of stuff that we're all engaged with. And in my eye, if I could totally rejig the museum, I would make rooms dedicated to that. We have managed to rearrange six rooms in the museum, not the whole museum, but six rooms, which are dedicated to big themes like money. We've got one on money, we've got one on sex, we've got one on politics. That's a good result. And the rest of the time, we're using these big captions, which we're putting next to them. And, you know, in the show, we look at everything from family relationships to political dynamics to, traveling, consumption, fashion, all of human life is here.
Interesting, isn't it? Maybe museums are full of the big themes, but they just don't know how to tell us what's going on. Are a bit ashamed of all the passions bubbling under all that oil and canvas and pottery. That was Alain de Botton telling me about his intervention at the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam. It's called Art is Therapy and runs throughout the Rijksmuseum's collection until the 7th of September. If you're not planning on heading there anytime soon, though, you could check out the Monocle film we just made, monocle.com/film. We museum hop to the Prado in Madrid next. We were just discussing what goes into improving the museum goer's experience. You may take the therapeutic route with Alain de Botton, or maybe you could just use an app. Art galleries and museums have had multimedia features since the introduction of audio guides, but now special apps are available which aim to add something that simple voiceovers can't. The Museo del Prado in Madrid has just launched a new iPad application which includes images of 14 of the museum's major works in such high definition that you can spot brushstrokes and cracks in the paint. Why would you need to see those? Well, to answer that question and take a very close look at some of the best works on show at El Prado, Monocle's David Phelan spoke to Gabriele Finaldi, Deputy Director of the Prado, and Iñaki Arrendondo from app developer Mad Pixel.
There is no substitution for standing in front of the picture, but I think an app like this can give real added value, whether you're a person who can visit the museum, or whether you want to explore the works of art in the museum from the comfort of your own home on your own TV screen. The app gives an extraordinary amount of visual information. It's true that in a museum you can get up close to a picture, but not as up close as this app. You can see details in this app which in the museum are practically impossible to see, either because they're too tiny or because there's a barrier in front of the picture, you can't get that close, or because it's just a very big picture. So one of the great advantages is the extraordinary detail that you can see in the picture. I mean, to see the tiny fly that Rubens paints at the very top of his picture sitting on a flower on one of his garlands in the painting of the Three Graces, that's an extraordinary experience. But there's so much more that the app offers.
Including images that you simply can't see if you're in the art gallery, such as an X-ray or an infrared version of it.
That's right. Technical examination of pictures has come a long way in the last decades. And the possibility of seeing a picture and then seeing the infrared photograph, which allows us to penetrate the paint layers and see the preparatory drawing that the artist made before beginning his painting, or seeing it in X-ray, it's like a medical X-ray, allows us to see right through the picture. So you get a real sense, first of all, of the kind of physical structure of the picture, but you also get a sense of the creative process, what the artist has gone through in order to get the finished results that you see in the gallery. So in a sense, these technical images that one can see very easily in relation to the surface picture enable you to take a sort of journey with the artist through the different moments of the creative process of the picture.
And how do you see the app being used? Will people come with their iPad to the art gallery, or will they simply use it as a way of seeing the image because they'll never make it? Or how do you expect it to be used?
My impression is that it'll be mostly used by people who don't come to the museum. It'll be used by people who maybe have come once before and enjoyed the experience very much. They want to take a bit of the museum home with them. They want to explore it at their desk or in the comfort of their living room.
So looking at this app itself, when we open it up, initially I get a list of several artworks, and including... aside, there are 14 masterpieces that are done in the special way, and that includes things like the audio guide, which is handy if you're walking around the museum. But then when I tap on the picture itself, it zooms into an incredibly detailed image. How big is that image, that gigapixel image?
Okay, this gigapixel image we say is ultra high definition because it's not just how big is it, it is, it's really huge, depending on the painting, but from tens to 100 times the picture you can take with a normal camera. So really, really huge. But also the quality is really important. So what we did is not just to go zoom till the brushstroke or even the canvas, but also to have the more amazing quality in artwork we can achieve right today.
Cool. So as I'm zooming in, it gets bigger and bigger, and as you say, I can see cracks in the paint, I can see individual brush strokes. Why is that so, I mean, it's amazing to look at, but why is that so useful in an app?
This is really useful. Combine it also with storytelling we have inside the app, with the stories the museum are putting inside the app, because it gives you all the interesting information the museum have. But you as a user, as a visitor to a museum, you don't have the possibility to have an expert together with you explain all that. So this is like having that expert and answering your question and increasing your curiosity. So you want to know more. The more you know, the more you want to learn about the painting and discover that story's detail or even the style of the painter.
Gabriele Finaldi, Deputy Director of Museo del Prado, and Iñaki Arredondo from Mad Pixel there, speaking to David Phelan, who got to play with the iPad app in front of Descent from the Cross by Roger van der Weyden.
The beret is not just a French cliché, it's a cherished piece of heritage at risk of extinction. Monocle Films pays a visit to the last beret maker in France and meets an Irishman trying to revive this quintessentially French piece of headwear.
L'Olaire has now earned the label of Living Heritage Company, Entreprise de Patrimoine Vivant, a reward from the French government to salute a firm's excellence in keeping alive a unique tradition. As the last manufacturer of a product so deeply ingrained in French DNA, L'Olaire and its berets are worth fighting for.
Vive le Beret, premiering on Monocle.com.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Now, you probably know John Ronson as a writer of amusing, disarming, probing and very influential books on the more weird and wonderful corners of the human experience. Psychopath, warlord Stanley Kubrick. His book about unusual military methods, The Men Who Stare at Goats, was turned into a feature film and a shortish reminiscent piece he wrote for The Guardian about his time playing keyboards with avant-pop oddball Frank Sidebottom of the huge, slightly spooky papier-mâché head has been made into Frank, a new film starring Michael Fassbender as the titular musician. Ronson co-wrote the script, transferring the action to Americans recording in Ireland rather than Brits chancing it around Manchester. But the feel's the same. And here is John Ronson on Making Frank.
I say tell everyone everything. Why cover anything up? Right?
How to describe Frank?
1, 2, 3, 4!
Well, there's the head, of course.
He never takes it off. You think it's weird? Would it help if I said my facial expressions out loud? Welcoming smile.
Delighted look.
But what goes on inside the head inside that head?
I find this inspiring.
Is music.
Something is pressing something else.
When I look back on my time with the real Frank Sidebottom, I realise that, you know, nothing makes a young man feel more like he's on an adventure than being in a transit van at 2 o'clock in the morning sitting next to a man wearing a big fake head. And I look back on that time with like incredible fondness. So I wrote this little article in The Guardian back in about 2006 about my time in the band. And it came out, I had no idea that it would, but it came out incredibly wistfully, like Stand By Me, but with a man with a big fake head. It came from some unexpected well of wistful sadness that I didn't know existed within me.
It's one of those things where we always think that when pieces of journalism or short stories or novels are adapted into films, almost the shorter the idea or the shorter the story, the better. Obviously, yeah. There's been a lot of drama that's been built around your quite small Guardian article back in the day. Did you have to sort of rack your brains to flesh it out, or was it quite nice to just take this article for a walk?
I think you're right about that. That original article that I wrote was like 2,000 words. And there was this one moment in it that really just had a kind of real resonance to it, which was I'm plucked from obscurity to join this band. And there's a moment where I just get on stage and start playing with this band. It was like Alice Through the Looking Glass. And you're right, I think that's the moment that made the film exist. And yeah, and then after that, there was like 5 years of horrendous trying to work out, you know, how to turn it into a whole movie. Horrendous because I'd never done anything like that before.
It's an unusual film, also about an unusual group of people. Yeah. Was there a way that you maybe wanted to sort of corral sense into this bunch of misfits? And it is very much a film, I guess, about misfits, and one in particular, which is Frank.
Exactly. You had to work out why this was happening, why it existed and why it needed to exist. And yeah, what it became, what it evolved into becoming, was a sort of celebration of life on the margins in a world that I feel is kind of increasingly conformist. At the moment, I'm writing a book about public shaming on the internet. Right. And the reason why I'm trying to do it is because I realise that, you know, the purpose of public shaming, even though us shamers don't quite realise that this is the purpose, it's kind of creating a more kind of conformist age. We're saying, look, everyone, look, we're normal. But, you know, and we're defining the boundaries of normality by becoming like furious with the people who transgress. So that's been on my mind a lot the last few years. And I think what Frank is, for me anyway, it's a film where actually you're sort of saying, look, here we are uncritically admiring life on the margins, people aiming low and so on. And that kind of evolved over the 5 years that we were writing the script.
The unmasking of Frank's head is kind of like when you see the shark in Jaws or something. You must have had to save up that moment as a scriptwriter, knowing when to do that.
You know what? That moment was never in there for a long, long time. Right. And we went off, me, Lenny and Peter, went off to a disused railway station near Alton Towers to write for a few days.
It sounds like the beginning of some wonderful joke.
Oh, it was terrifying. Honestly, even if you don't believe in ghosts like I don't, try walking into a disused railway station. All you see are like the ghosts of Victorian ladies and gentlemen just all staring at you on the platform. But it had been turned into like a accommodation, so we rented it for about a week. It was a really intense week, actually, and we'd walk along the disused track kind of talking about the film. And I remember the exact moment where one of us said, well, you know, surely John's going to want to try and pull his head off. Until that moment, that was never a factor, but then suddenly it was like, you know, of course.
And in terms of the casting, obviously you've got Michael Fassbender under that head for the whole movie, and I watched it quite a long time ago, I think before it was branded as having him in it, or in a way, and I was amazed. It was a nice sort of ripple, a little murmur, obviously, in the screening room when I saw it, when the head comes off. Was that an intention to sort of have him in it but never really know whether it was him underneath the hat?
I did always think, you know, an actor who has their choice of parts would probably really like the challenge of having to wear a big fake head throughout the entirety of the movie. But I never thought Michael Fassbender. And then suddenly someone said, oh, Michael Fassbender's read the script and wants to play Frank. And we sent a message back saying, is he definitely aware that he spends the entirety of a movie in a big fake head?
And that's the sell.
Yeah, and the message came back saying, yeah, he is aware of that.
And in terms of the verite of playing the music in this, with this unpronounceable band of which Frank is the boss man, I understand that all happened live and all the actors played their instruments.
Yeah, apparently so. I didn't
come in and play your major C. In person.
No. I didn't spend any time on the set other than like the first day. I spent the first day on the set.
Yeah.
The set's no place for a writer. It's a sort of, because
you see, you know, it being dismantled slightly.
Well, it's not so much that. It's more like you've done your job and it's not your job anymore. You know, so all you can do is stand there feeling odd. I didn't want to influence people.
Finally, I wondered how you feel that Frank Sidebottom, the real Frank Sidebottom, whose band you played in Chris Civi, is no longer with us. This film will become better known than he was as a performer, almost. Do you think?
Well, I'm not sure. You know, all the publicity that's happened so far about the film has
Do you think it boosts the original act?
I mean, you know, he's the real Frank Sidebottom's like on the front page of The Guardian today. And there's this documentary coming out called Being Frank, which is a documentary about the real Frank and its real story. I think this film, this fictional film, is going to boost Frank and that documentary more than anything. However, I would say this. I brought out this book called Frank, the True Story, that inspired the movie, and I've done like this speaking tour. And I was in Hebden Bridge at the Trades Club in Hebden Bridge giving a talk a couple of weeks ago. The old bass player from the Frank Sidebottom Band came to see me at Hebden Bridge, and the place was sold out. And he said, you know, if I'd come with Frank Sidebottom, the place would have been half full. Yeah. And it is a bit of a, you don't know what you've got till it's gone. It's like, it is kind of sad that some people out there, there's a lot of people who loved him when he was alive, but there are people out there who only retrospectively realise that they loved him. I think Chris would have loved to have seen all of this happening, and I think that is really sad. However, you know, his wife Paula and his kids, you know, Sterling and Harry and Gemma, are getting to see it all. And Harry is incredibly thrilled to see everything that's happening. And so, you know, in a way, Chris is getting to see it through the eyes of his children.
That was John Ronson talking to us about Frank, which is out now and highly recommended. Still to come in part two, we'll speak to the boss of Art Basel Hong Kong to see what's selling and who's buying, he hopes. We'll meet the embodiment of the moment where rock and roll and photography meet. Lynn Goldsmith is here. And books in Bogota and more from our Midori House session from Hamilton Lighthouser. Stay very much tuned, my friends. Plenty more to come, all here on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. Our Midori House session this week comes from the former Walkman frontman Hamilton Lighthouser. Hamilton now has a new solo album, Black Hours, about to hit the shelves, which he recorded at Vox Studios in LA. And fresh from it, he came into Midori House to sing and speak to Monocle's Tom Hall.
Alexandra is off my record. They're both from my record, Black Hours. They're sort of the up-tempo ones from the record. The record doesn't necessarily sound like those, but they're the only ones I think I knew how to play on acoustic and sing.
Yeah, the new record, Black Hours, that title, I mean, is that a referral to maybe kind of, is it like a late night sound, or is it kind of like a dark night of the soul? What is that?
It sounded to me like a nighttime sort of nightclub sound, but maybe more in sort of a classic sense. The album was very inspired by Frank Sinatra specifically, and a lot of sort of older maybe jazz singers and stuff. And to me, it was like sort of a direct nod to maybe In the Wee Small Hours and September of My Years.
Even though it's kind of looking back to maybe a slightly historical sound, the talent on the album is very contemporary. You've got people from Vampire Weekend and Fleet Foxes, is that right?
Yeah, I was really lucky with the lineup.
And what did they bring to it?
Ton. I mean, they changed everything. Every guy you hire, and this is the first time I've ever worked with anyone besides the guys that I grew up with. And it's a big decision who you hire, because they really, when you're in the recording studio, can add a whole different dimension. So you get guys like Morgan Henderson in there. He can play anything, and he'll just pick up the marimba. And he's so good at anything musical that you'll just start replacing all the guitar tracks with marimba tracks. And before you know it, you have like a marimba rocker. I didn't expect that I'd be writing like marimba rockers.
And what about the place that you recorded in? You recorded in Vox Studios, right? Which is,
yeah.
I read that this is the oldest recording studio.
Privately owned, continuously open, yeah.
And is that the gear old as well, or is it up to date?
Yeah, he has this board that you can see what was recorded. I mean, so much stuff. The Grateful Dead, Neil Young, Creedence Clearwater Revival, you name it, in L.A. and San Francisco, and they've done a classic record, like 5 Tom Waits records. Beach Boys stuff there. It's like an incredible room. It's privately owned, and I guess the guy is a little bit difficult who runs it, but my friend Rossum got me in the door, and it was a magical room.
And the themes of the record, there's a song on there called Self-Pity. Is that kind of almost sort of moroseness? Is that kind of quite a humorful take?
Definitely. I mean, I realized, you know, since all these songs are really inspired by a record like September of My Years, you look at what I like most about it, and I'm not really into the up-tempo, jazzy, in-your-face, Count Basie kind of stuff. That stuff always sort of just gets on my nerves. And I really like the much more self-pitying, like, poor, pitiful me, pathetic figure that somebody like Frank will put on, and the girls go wild, and it's like such an act. Nobody believes that Frank is that down. I mean, but it's funny, and it's dark. So I wanted to call a song Self-Pity. I mean, I wanted to call the record that, but I guess maybe it was a little too, it didn't have that much humor in it. But yeah, it was just a nod to that character, sort of.
As we speak now, I mean, we are only but a few weeks since the very last gig of your former band, The Walkmen.
Yeah.
Moving on from that, a lot of those guys are people that you grew up with, and I gather, you know, you're really close friends.
Oh, yeah.
And some of them are family on the record, right?
Yes, Paul Maroon and I wrote a lot of the songs together. He's a guitar player.
Did you have to consciously try and sort of step away from that group of people, perhaps? Was it a conscious step to limit maybe?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Involvement, of course.
Yeah.
That was one of the main reasons. I mean, it has nothing to do with anybody in particular, but you get into a groove with 5 people, and I had a batch of songs, and I was looking at them, and I was thinking, we all live in different cities. To get everybody together is such a process. It puts a weight on everything, and I thought, I don't know if I want to put these songs through that same gamut that it's gone through.
Yeah.
It's funny, because it's really, you can't put your finger on why, but it's so daunting, the idea of doing it all again. I didn't know how we were going to do it differently, and nobody else did either, so we all sort of agreed, you know, people have different songs. Maybe we should just try to do it separately.
And do you find that the location you're in, further than the studio, but the actual city, like, I mean, decamping to LA, I mean, you're a New York guy, is that right? Does that influence the sound of a record? Like, I mean, The Walkmen recorded a record in Lisbon, and do you absorb those influences where you are?
I've never been able to write music outside of New York City, and I don't know why. And it's getting worrisome because I have 2 daughters now, and it's really expensive place to live. And I'd love to look at real estate out somewhere else, but it honestly worries me to leave. I've tried writing in like DC and other places where I've spent a little time, Boston, and it doesn't happen. I don't know why that is. I have no idea why that is, but it definitely hasn't happened in like 13 years. So I think I'm very influenced by the place I'm in, and I don't know why. So going to L.A., we ended up doing a lot of stuff out in L.A. We did the whole recording there, and I've been back a lot recently, and I've made a lot of friends, and I've never really liked L.A., to be honest, up until recently, and now I've really come to sort of coming around.
That was Hamilton Lighthouser speaking to Monocle's Tom Hall, and you can hear another track from the album at the end of the show. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. In a week, we'll be toasting year two of Art Basel Hong Kong. For this edition, the fair will be welcoming 245 of the world's most influential galleries in the city that just a few years ago could have been described as an artistic desert. Now, Hong Kong is a major hub for the Asian art market, and to discuss the role of Art Basel in that artistic renaissance, we sent Justin Bergman to meet Magnus Renfrew, the director of the fair.
This year, we're really building on the first year's success. We've been inundated with applications this year, with over 550 applications, from which 245 galleries have been selected by our selection committee. So the quality across the board is really exceptional this year. We have, as I say, 245 galleries from 39 countries, and so the breadth of representation of the work on view is something that really sets this fair apart from other fairs. Over 50% of the galleries have spaces in Asia and the Asia-Pacific region. And so I think, in a sense, the fair really helps to present the new reality, if you like, of the new art world. I think that as recently as 5 or 10 years ago, people, when they were talking about the art world, were talking really about the United States and Europe. And this fair really helps to demonstrate how diverse the work that's being produced around the world is today.
Well, to kind of continue on that thought, how important is the Asian art market these days? And are we seeing, I mean, is this where growth is going to be happening for the next, I don't know, 10 or 15 years? Is this the future of the art world?
There's huge potential in Asia. Clearly in Europe and the United States, the markets are quite established already. And so they're mature markets, if you like. There are always new collectors coming through in Europe and the United States as well. But Asia, I think, has enormous potential. There are many different collector bases around Asia. Whilst one might talk about China, it's not solely about China. There are many important collectors in Southeast Asia, in Taiwan, Korea, and also in Australia. And that's been one of the big surprises for us in Hong Kong, is the importance of the fair for the Australian audience. But we are at an earlier stage of development with the art scene and with the collecting scene in Asia. And there are now more billionaires in Asia than there are in Europe. By 2015, the combined net worth of the high net worth individuals in Asia and the Asia Pacific is set to outshine that of the United States. So it really demonstrates that there's the buying power there, but it's really about developing the market. It's about developing an understanding of the gallery scene, why the gallery scene is important, what galleries do for artists beyond selling work in terms of building their careers for the long term and building a curatorial and a critical framework for understanding their work.
In terms of having the 50-50 split between Asian and Western galleries and art as well, how important is it for Art Basel Hong Kong to retain an Asian flavor compared to the other Art Basel editions? And do you think that the Asian art and the Asian galleries are as prominently represented as the Western ones at this point? And will that grow?
It's vitally important for the show in Hong Kong to have a very strong identity. The show should be very much rooted in the place in which it happens, and needs a strong representation of galleries from Asia and the Asia Pacific region. That's very, very clear. And in fact, that's in keeping with the other two Art Basel shows. For example, in Art Basel in Switzerland, 50% of the galleries come from Europe. In Miami Beach, 50% of the galleries come from the Americas, so both from North America and from Latin America. And in Hong Kong, 50% of the galleries come from Asia and the Asia Pacific. That's something that we see as fundamentally important to the success of the fair, also from a pragmatic perspective, because it's our experience that the majority of collectors for any show tend to come from the region in which the fair takes place. And so it's important to make sure that you have work that they're comfortable with and feel familiar with, and that they feel that their region is being properly represented.
Lastly, what are you most excited about this year? Is it the inclusion of a film section as a new part of the Art Basel Hong Kong, or are there specific artists and galleries that you're excited about?
There are many things this year that I think are worthy of note. The discovery sector, which is the sector for emerging artists, and it tends to be younger galleries that are presenting those artists. This sector has been very, very much oversubscribed this year. We've had an incredible level of interest. And I think what it demonstrates is that for those galleries that are going to be in this business for the next 20 or 30 years, they really see Asia as being absolutely central to their long-term strategies. I enjoy that sector personally because it's an opportunity to see work that one perhaps hasn't seen before, to find new artists or younger artists at an earlier stage in their career. Another thing that I'm particularly excited about is the insight sector, which is dedicated to either solo or thematic presentations by artists from Asia, represented by galleries from Asia and the Asia Pacific. And one of the things that we're trying to do is to develop the more historical material in that sector. And we have one or two very, very strong presentations of that historical material this year. So we have, for example, we have a booth dedicated to work of Chu Yat-sai. We also have a booth of work dedicated to the ink artist Liu Ko-song, who is a very important figure in the contemporary ink movement. So those are two of the highlights. But in addition to that, I think that the encounters sector, where one really gets to see the large-scale installations that transcend the traditional booth format, I think it's really interesting to break up the fair in that respect. And we've been going through the applications with Yuko Hasegawa. We've got some great works that will be coming up at the show this year. And of course, the new departure for us is the film sector this year, which is a presentation of work of in the moving image. So it can be either video art, or it can be short films by artists, or documentaries about an artist's work. And we've actually received more applications for the film sector in Hong Kong than traditionally Art Basel or Miami Beach have received. And so I think that's a testament to the importance of the moving image in China, in Hong Kong and in Asia. And I'm very excited about what that's going to bring.
That was Magnus Renfrew, Asia Director of Art Basel, speaking to Monocle's Justin Bergman. Art Basel Hong Kong will kick off on May the 15th until the 18th. Up next, rock and roll.
The Monocle subscription package is your year-round entry into the world of Monocle. For £90, you get a year of Monocle in print, and that's 10 magazines, including two double issues and our two seasonal newspapers, Alpino and Mediterraneo. You'll get access to online archives and an exclusive tote bag designed by our in-house team and made by our friends at Rutote of Japan. Plus, free shipping to wherever you are in the world. And that's all for £90 sterling. Or you can double your fun with our two-year package for £170, which comes with two bags and our exclusive organiser. So treat yourself, or even a loved one, to a Monocle subscription, available at monocle.com.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bounce. Now for a legend behind the camera and making wonderful images in front of it. Since the 1960s, Lynn Goldsmith has photographed generations of rock stars, making icons of some, absorbing the star quality of others, working across onstage, backstage, album covers and magazine shoots with the likes of Bruce Springsteen, Michael Jackson, U2 and Bob Marley. In fact, everyone who is anyone. Her book, Rock and Roll Stories, is out now. Take it away, Lynn.
I don't think that there was any intention on my part in documenting so many musicians over a course of time, and it just so happened that in my own path of writing songs and going to school with people who had the same interests as I did, that I ended up making images that other people wanted to see because I could present a certain point of view. An example would be when I was signing up for classes at the University of Michigan. It was the first day of school in Ann Arbor, and I'm standing there with one guy who has an afro and another guy who has long hair and kind of big eyes like me. And this guy with the afro says, "You, your name is famous." And I thought, oh, okay. And then he said to this other guy, "You, your name is Iggy. Me, I'm Panther White, and we're the White Panther Party."
You mentioned Iggy Pop right there already. Now, he seems like a man that was made to be photographed, right? He was a man that always looked... he always looked good, but he always looked kind of iconic on his covers and then lots of the press shots and in the photos you've taken of him.
Well, Iggy was, as Jim Osterberg.
You know,
we used to sit in the coffee house, and when people would come in, we were just talking, Iggy would start picking his nose because it would upset people. And... those are some of the tidbits you get in rock and roll stories.
It starts with picking your nose, ends in punk.
Yes.
That's right. It ends in Berlin with David Bowie somewhere, doesn't it? And you've done a lot. You've done a sort of run the gamut of styles as well. You've done the posed album covers for people. You've done a lot of on the road stuff behind, backstage and on stage. Where are you most comfortable? I mean, are you comfortable ranging around trying to get that, not trying to get the access necessarily, but trying to get the image no one else has got? Or do you like to be in a studio with the assistants, with the lights just so, and with a portrait, with a person sitting down for their portrait?
Well, basically, I think I'm a photo slut. And I like to
That's the take-home quote right there, Lynn.
I like to do it all, Yeah. I don't want to just do conceptual studio portraits. I also want to be a documentary photographer in the style of Magnum, showing what it is, the life that people lead to present the image of who they want others to think they are, how they want to see themselves. Everything that I do has always been about identity, whether it was my Will Powers project or any of the photographs that I make.
And who needed to be sort of corralled a little bit, tidied up for the camera? Who was very interested in the power their own image had? I know you shot Michael Jackson, obviously, and Springsteen, all these people, and you too as well, who photography has played a great part in our understanding of them as acts. But who was almost trying to do your job for you, or did that never happen? I mean, I think of Anton Corbijn's relationship with U2, and he was always like the fifth member of the band, it seemed. Those album covers in the 80s were so strong.
Well, I think every photographer who does portraiture, their job is to, as quickly as possible, become whoever is on the opposite side of the camera, to become their new best friend. And the best photographers can do that. So there are certain situations where you're incredibly fortunate, like with Patty or Iggy, where those people truly love the camera. But generally speaking, most people, whether they're famous or not famous, feel like the photographer is, equal to going to the dentist. And it's not something that they want to partake in. So if you can create a collaboration, and those are the pictures, like with Frank Zappa, mm-hmm. Bruce, people who are not necessarily as comfortable in front of the camera. It's really rare that I've been fortunate enough to have anyone in front of the camera that is able to help me go to the next level of creativity because of what they bring to it.
So the most successful of your portraits or your work with bands, whether it's kind of posed or stolen, is a collaboration always between the subject and your camera?
Oh, it's always a collaboration no matter what. You have to have that collaboration. But what I'm more or less getting at is Patty taught me a lot about how important styling was in images, and Debbie Harry, she was my friend, and she was a cosmetologist before she was ever a singer, and Debbie taught me how to do makeup. So in my day of making images with musicians, the idea of makeup and clothing was something you had to entice them into doing, whereas now no photo shoot would probably take place without books being looked at for stylists and groomers, hair and makeup people. So it was, it was fortunate for me that I could make people look like what they wanted the world to think they looked like, with the subtlety of how I would change their clothes.
And, well, I mean, it sounds like you obviously got on very well with a lot of these people. People use first name terms a lot in the creative industries, don't they? But it sounds like you became friends with a lot of the people.
I became friends with the ones I liked.
Muses, yeah. but does that, what happens when there is always boundaries? There are always boundaries with these things. Did that allow you to take better pictures, or did that sometimes you think, God, I can't really shoot this? There are things backstage, maybe things on stage, that you kind of feel like you can't document because you're buddies with them, because you go out for a beer with them after the gig.
Boundaries were never something that appealed to me.
And, that's what I like.
And actually, on the back of my last book with Abrams, Rock and Roll, Tom Petty has a quote about me, which I was quite pleased with. He said, you know, the reason that Lynn was the best was because she was like us. She questioned authority. So, no, these people don't have authority over me. Nobody has authority over me but me.
And that was Lynn Goldsmith, and Rock and Roll Stories is out now. It's beautiful and funny, and do not dare put it anywhere near a coffee table. Do you hear? Because it's not a coffee table book. Just a few days ago, the world mourned one of Latin America's most legendary authors, and I really mean it. His life and writing were the stuff of legends. I'm talking about Gabriel Garcia Marquez, of course, the daddy of what we call magical realism, and Colombia's first ever best-selling novelist. Now Bogotá is hosting its 27th International Book Fair, which features, amongst others, Garcia Marquez's nemesis and other Nobel laureate from the region, Mario Vargas Llosa. But aside from those big names, who's selling Latin American novels these days? Well, we sent Monocle's correspondent Anastasia Maloney to have a gander around the fair and a chat with the organisers.
Peru's national anthem plays alongside Colombia's at the opening of the Bogotá Book Fair, the 27th edition of the event that honours Peruvian writers and in particular one of the greats of Latin American literature, Nobel laureate Mario Vargas Llosa. After the pomp and fanfare, it's time for Peruvian pisco cocktails and ceviche, and of course, to sell books, as the fair's director Enrique González points out.
We have clients as important as the United States, Mexico, and Central America. We export our books. At this book fair, business gets done. Last year, the book fair generated $12 million in book sales during the year. And there's also the expectation that those contracts that have been made at the fair will lead to more business deals.
Perhaps as a sign that the Chavista ideology isn't quite the style of the fair, Vargas Llosa, a longtime opponent of Venezuela's and Cuba's socialist governments, is the man pulling in the crowds.
Lo recibirá no un ser humano sino una computadora. Y desapareció.
When this author is a Nobel Prize, it's bigger for everyone. And this is also very important. These things call people. And people is coming because there is somebody like him.
Juan Camilo Sierra heads Mexico's Economic Culture Fund in Colombia, a leading publishing house funded by the Mexican government, and the reason why Mexican literature dominates Latin America's publishing industry.
I remember once, long ago, in Guadalajara's book fair, I'd been with Carlos Monsiváis, and we were walking together to a presentation of one of his books, and we crossed Gabriel García Márquez, and the people followed him as if he were a saint. Everybody wanted to touch it to be better. This happens with literature, and this happens with the authors for everyone.
Everyone here is talking about the lasting legacy of Colombia's own Nobel laureate, Gabriel García Márquez, as his books once again become bestsellers following his recent death in April. But as González tells me, there's a new generation of writers often with a background in journalism and supported by small local publishing houses, who are drawing from their own reality as Latin America emerges from dictatorships and civil wars. Colombia's 50-year bloody conflict is no exception.
In Colombia, after the magical realism of García Márquez, there was a lost generation, because the writers after him either wanted to be like him or completely different. They were hugely influenced by Márquez because of his enormous importance and reach. Now there's a generation which is more free, and they are dedicated to telling the reality, because in Colombia, reality surpasses fiction. It's such a violent country, but writing about our reality is like a catharsis that allows us to know the reality we're living.
Lima-born writer Gabriela Viner, who is one of 70 Peruvian writers launching a book at the fair, says non-fiction, that's based on a mix of testimony, confession and autobiography, is a popular genre among Latin American writers today.
A strong trend, I think, are those writers who combine a bit of intimacy and memory of the recent political violence of Latin America. Jeremias Gamboa has been a bestseller in Peru. He sold more books in Peru than Mario Vargas Llosa. It's amazing, really. In Peru, a place where copyright piracy reigns, and where no editorial house believes they can make a lot of money, if 10,000 copies are sold, that's a bestseller. Normal writers sell about 1,000 books.
But aside from the academics, Latin Americans don't know about writers outside of their own country. The talk at this book fair is how to literally spread the word, as Sierra from the Mexican Economic Culture Fund explains.
The one bad thing is that after Spain opened the doors to the world, after Franco's death, the publishing houses from Spain came to America, and they decided to settle it in the most important markets, Mexico, Argentina, and Colombia. And once they start to work, they decided only to keep the frontiers. So Latin American authors doesn't travel with its books around America. An Argentinian is well known in Argentina and nobody knows about him in Colombia, in Ecuador, in Brazil, or Peru. And also happened with the Colombian people. And this is bad. This is so bad. And I think that we have the responsibility to broke that.
Yet fairs like this one manage to break those literary borders. Here's hoping that, as Latin America and its economies emerge, so too will its book market. For Monocle in Bogota, I'm Anastasia Malone.
Thanks, Anastasia. And that's just about all we have time for this week. Next time, we'll be discussing art and crime in novels, TV and elsewhere. Don't be scared to tune in. It's just a radio show, cats. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, my producer with Daphne Denny, and Toby Hammond was the man with his fingers on the dials and the faders and the switches this week because Holly Fisher's off on holiday. How dare she, I know, but nonetheless, she'll be back next time. We've still got time for final track from this week's Midori House session. Here is Hamilton Lighthouser with 11 o'clock Friday night. Thank you, as ever, for tuning in.
Some silent night you want.